Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program is brought to you by Karen Carbon Partners, a food business consultancy that helps clients explore the interconnections among agriculture, food, policy, and people. For more information, visit kknp.com.
Hi, this is Katie Kiefer from What Doesn't Kill You? Food Industry Insights, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Sharp and Hot. I am your host, Chef Emily Peterson, coming to you live from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This is episode number 118 on a dreary, rainy day that I just keep telling myself is not frozen precipitation. I had my seed catalogs out this weekend. I have a million things, far more than I have room for, to plant. And I'm super excited. And on the note of planting things, I want to start right at the top of the show with my guest, author Liz Carlisle, who has written a book called Lentil Underground. And Liz, I understand that you have been doing radio interviews all day long.
I started bright and early watching the sunrise here on the West Coast, yes.
That is amazing. So you can feel free to feel a little slappy if you want to on Sharp and Hot. It's a very conversational place.
Awesome, awesome. I figured with the title, you were ready to have some fun.
That's what we aim for. Okay, so I was sent your book, Lentil Underground, and it is riveting. You're an amazing storyteller, and you have managed to take this topic of organic lentil farming in America's, would you call it heartland?
Yeah.
Is that
the
right? Because I'm like the quintessential New Yorker. I understand the East Coast and some of the West Coast and everything in the middle. I'm a little blurry on. But tell me the origin story of how you came upon these renegade farmers.
Well, I'm from Montana, so, you know, I could have just gone over the mountains when I was a kid, but it turned into more of kind of a circuitous path. My first career was as a country singer, and in the course of that work, I was meeting farmers all over the country who said, you know, yeah, all that beautiful stuff you're saying about Jeffersonian democracy and taking care of the land, but it's pretty hard to do when the grain elevator will only buy one thing. So I became aware of some of these issues with the food system, the farm bill, the structure of agriculture, and I quit my job as a country singer and went to work for an organic farmer from my home state who'd gotten elected to the U.S. Senate, John Tester. And, you know, I thought this was one guy bucking the system, and I quickly found out that he was part of this rural social movement, and I got really curious about it, and that's how I found myself back in Montana interviewing lentil farmers.
So I feel like, first of all, I love career changer stories, and how do you walk away from a career on stage? That seems like so much fun.
Well, you know, it just wasn't seeming honest anymore. It was like, you know, how can I tell stories about people connecting to the land and serving their community when there are these obstacles to people actually doing that, you know, that I'm not doing anything about? It felt terrible. These shows were sponsored by these big food companies, and it was just like, ugh, there's something hypocritical in all this if I don't, you know, go to Washington and do my part.
So I feel like people have kind of two views, that both of which they know to be true, one of which they want to be true, of sort of where our food comes from, particularly in the United States. And one part of it is this like beautiful pastoral red barn with silos and sunrise, and like that's where we want our food to come from. But we also know about Monsanto and monocropping, and we know about like the soybeans and the high fructose corn syrup and all this terrible stuff. And I feel like most people just, I don't know, like when you're in the grocery store, just like, ah, whatever, you know, like that, all both of those stories kind of go out the window. And so bringing authenticity back to the story is huge.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think one of my messages is that you absolutely can know where your food comes from. You can know your farmer, build that relationship. Certainly, you know, if it's produce that you're growing in your own garden or that you're buying at the farmer's market. But it's also possible to do that with grains and with legumes. You know, I'm calling this idea more of like a domestic fair trade model. There's a domestic fair trade association. And the sense that we do build that those relationships and that transparency, even at a little bit of a distance, you know, much like we do with coffee or bananas from Central America.
I call it being a pragmatic locavore. Like, I'm not giving up avocados and olive oil, but I want them to, I want to know that they were local to someone.
Well, it's important. You know, I mean, I think local food is part of the solution, but I don't think it's the whole solution. And I think it's actually really good to support farmers in other places who are, you know, stewarding an ecologically sensitive region and don't have the financial resources within that region to fully support the farm system. And that's certainly the case with these lentils. You know, only 1 million people in Montana. It's a fairly depressed agricultural rural economy out there. So in order for people to steward those ecosystems that, you know, impact all of us through climate change and other pathways, they need to have partners in places like Brooklyn.
Right. And here we are eating them up. So why why the lentil? There's you go into such eloquent detail about why the lentil as opposed to some other crop, but why lentils are so important.
Yeah, well, you know, you mentioned there for a minute the chemically supported grain monoculture systems. So in Montana, in much of that part of the country, that was wheat. A little bit of barley, but, you know, monoculture grain. And in order to support a monoculture grain system, you need to use a lot of chemicals. Those grains take a lot of nitrogen out of the soil every time you plant them. So farmers were using fossil fuel-based chemicals to put that nitrogen back in. This was running off into the water supply, creating dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico, huge culprit in terms of the climate footprint in agriculture, all the fossil fuel required to make that synthetic nitrogen, bankrupting farmers because it's really expensive, and when the fossil fuel markets go up, you're spending all this money on fertilizer. So they needed a plant that could provide those fertilizer, the fertility service in place of the chemical if they were going to get off of this chemical treadmill. And so it had to be something from the bean and pea family, legumes. These are plants that can pull nitrogen out of the atmosphere where it's abundant and then fix it into a plant available form, working with bacteria in the soil. So it's available not just for that plant, that bean or pea family plant, but anything that follows too. Now, there's a lot of choices, obviously, of plants in the bean family, but in Montana, the growing seasons are really short, and there's not that much rain. So they had kind of a small menu of options, and it turns out what really worked for them within their climate were lentils.
And so these farmers have, and I need you to pronounce your main farmer's last name for me because I'm scared I'm going to butcher it.
David Oyen.
Oyen. Okay, so David Oyen is sort of the steward of this. Is that, would that be correct? And then he has gotten other farmers, he sort of convinced them to join his tribe and also grow lentils, correct?
Yes, yeah.
And so he, in turn, has he has this like entrepreneurial vision that it's not just a matter of getting people off of the monocropping and the chemical fertilizers, but he's also managed to get it onto the shelves in Whole Foods. And I'm wondering if you can, what was that path like, or can you draw that line between having this vision and then making it financially possible?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, the first step was got to get off the chemicals, have to get out of the commodity market. You know, we're going to go bankrupt that way, and people are getting cancer, and this is bad for the soil, and all these other reasons. So, you know, he figures out lentils is what he's going to need to plant in rotation in order to have a successful farm without chemical inputs. And he's experimenting with a bunch of his friends, you know, when do you plant the lentils, what kinds of lentils, how far do you space them apart, all these different things, you know, that you need to learn in the course of totally switching your farming system. And, you know, their land-grant university scientists weren't totally sold on the idea yet, so they had to do quite a lot of their own science in this respect. But But then the big question was, where are we going to sell them? Because they weren't used to direct-to-consumer type of marketing. In the commodity market, as a farmer, there's a grain elevator in town. You drive your truck down there, you dump your grain in there, and then, you know, somebody else takes care of it from there. But there weren't any lentil elevators in town. So they had to pool resources. It started with four farmers just in the outbuildings of Dave's farm, you know, putting these lentils in 25-pound bags and starting to see if anybody was interested in buying them. And then ultimately, a larger group of farmers got together, leased a grain elevator, you know, and started to get to the point where they could think about, you know, okay, food grade, grocery stores, distribution network. And now they have this small business, Timeless Natural Food, and you can buy them in Brooklyn.
How long did that take, sort of from Dave's first inkling that this is what he was going to do to now?
Some time. So Dave goes back to his family farm when he's 27 years old in 1976 and tells his dad, I'd like to go organic, and I'd like to put solar panels on the roof of the farmhouse.
How'd that go over?
You can imagine how that conversation went. So then, some experimenting, some generational conversations. By the mid-80s, he's working through this nonprofit organization, Alternative Energy Resources Organization, with some other farmers. They get going with some farm improvement clubs in the 90s. The business is started in 1987. They really get their first major contracts to sell lentils to somebody who's, you know, direct to consumer in the mid 90s. So it's definitely been a gradual process to get where they are today.
I've been doing a lot of meditating on the role of patience in how things happen. And as I was reading the story, I was like, this is a really good allegory for needing patience in things.
That is so spot on. And it is one of the reasons why I wanted to get involved in this project and work with this group of people, is I don't think that is the foremost quality of my personality.
Me neither.
Or, you know, sort of what I was trained, maybe, if I'm going to be friendlier to myself. I think I was sort of trained with a more immediate gratification kind of model of success and, you know, how you pursue your life's goals. And I saw that here's a group of people that can pursue something that's going to take longer than their own lifetimes. And how does that change you as a person if that's the time scale you think on?
And so if with the 40 years or so of reflection, has there been backlash on the part of the buyers and sellers in the commodity market?
You know, I don't know if it was so much backlash. It was more just being ignored, you know, kind of like a skepticism, and beyond skepticism, really, just kind of like a snickering, I think, at the beginning, is just like, that's cute. You're going to grow lentils without chemicals.
Right.
It wasn't taken seriously for some time. Now I think, you know, organics is a $35 billion industry, maybe upwards of that. There's definitely backlash at this point from agribusiness corporations who are somewhat concerned about their business model. They're fighting these laws to label GMOs and that sort of thing. So on a national level, I think there is a culture war being promulgated by companies that are worried that their products might become obsolete
if we
transition to organics.
Yeah, I understand the breakfast cereal industry is scrambling because sugar breakfast cereals are plummeting as people are like, oh, not the best fuel for my kid before school.
Yeah. I mean, it's a sea change in the way Americans think about their diets. And I really credit a very broad-based social movement for that. You look at all the parents who are paying attention to what's, you know, being fed to their kids at school and, you know, people getting involved in community gardens. It's just wonderful. It makes you hopeful about the state of American democracy.
And boy, do we need some hope. I need to take a very quick break. When we come back, can I ask you if you feel like this is something you can talk about? I would love some insight into the world of GMOs because I get asked about it all the time and I need some expert advice.
All right.
Okay.
I'll do my best.
Awesome. We will be right back after a quick break.
We'll be right back.
Karen Carbon Partners is a food business consultancy that helps clients explore the interconnections among agriculture, food, policy, and people. They help coordinate executives, school and government officials, distributors, and farmers think clearly about how food is produced, processed, and distributed, encouraging them to overcome challenges and pursue innovation. Their Good Food is Good Business division supports the healthy development, execution, and operations of food businesses and initiatives in the public and private sectors through strategic sourcing, feasibility analysis, market research, business planning, project management, and evaluation. Their Good People are Good Business division builds leadership and organizational effectiveness through talent and performance management, organizational assessment, executive coaching, recruiting, and employee engagement services. For more than 20 years, Karen Carbon Partners has been integral to the development and execution of food businesses, policies, and partnerships in the U.S. and the U.K. Visit them on the web at kknp.com.
Welcome back to Sharp and Hot. I am Emily Peterson talking to Liz Carlisle, author of Lentil Underground. So right before the break, I asked if you could give me some insight into GMOs, because this is a place where I don't know what to say to people, and I would love some help.
Well, obviously, probably one of the most heated topics of conversation about food and agriculture right now. You know, do we need GMOs? Are they safe? All these kinds of issues. Here's my thinking on it from what I have learned, is that we don't know if they're safe because we don't have any long-term data. This is a pretty new technology. I don't think there's a lot of convincing evidence that they're unsafe, but it's a little bit of a precautionary principle thing there is just, gosh, you know, these have really only been around for a short period of time. We don't really know what the impacts are on the environment or on human health. The bigger issue, I think, is really from the perspective of the structure of the agricultural industry and the food industry, because they introduce a much different pattern of ownership, which is to say, you know, those are seeds. It's the only time in many, many decades when Americans thought it was okay to own life. That used to be against the law, but you can now patent these seeds, and it gives the corporations who produce them just an unprecedented level of control over not just the seed, but really quite a lot of the food system as a result. You know, it's a bad deal for the farmer for that reason. The other reason it's a bad deal for the farmer is that many countries around the world have decided they don't want GMOs. So, you know, it cuts out entire markets. And farmers don't get to make this decision on an individual basis if there's any GMO contamination found in their states because of test plots or, you know, because of commercial plantings. You know, countries will just say, oh, no, we're not going to accept wheat from your state because it might be GMO and we don't allow that. You know, and then I think the final thing I would say is that the typical argument for GMOs is that we need them to feed the world. And this is just completely erroneous because, A, we already produce enough food for everybody to eat. The problem is, you know, distribution issues, lack of democracy, food waste. That's why people don't have enough food to eat. It's not that we're not producing enough. And then, you know, the other assumption that I think is faulty there is that GMOs are the path there. We don't actually see very much GMO development for any kind of agricultural quality that would lead to more resilient production in a time of climate change. It's mostly been to resist certain kinds of herbicides. And my thinking is, you know, in the face of climate change and these variable weather conditions we can't predict, what we really need is more diversity in the crops. I mean, literally genetic diversity so that we have a backup plan, you know, if something fails, if weather or climate, you know, dictates that a certain variety isn't going to fare very well. So engineering a more precise gene pool seems like the wrong way to go. And there are these arguments about breeding and drought tolerance or this or that. But, you know, that assumes that you can predict with precision what the conditions are that you're going to face. And I think our reality is exactly the opposite.
I don't think I've ever asked a better question. That was awesome. You're absolutely right. Yeah, I mean, when you put it like that, it's like, well, yeah, it doesn't really, it's not about that. So I had a similar experience asking once about sustainable seafood, and somebody said, well, think, try to think of it like you're sustaining the people, not the fish. And it was like that same eye-opening moment, like, yeah, we're talking about owning life. Like, holy smokes, that's the direction that we come at this from. Well, I just got a major education. Thank you, Liz.
Thanks, Emily.
So the book is called Lentil Underground. It is produced by Penguin. Do I say Avery Penguin or Penguin Avery? I think Avery.
Avery is an imprint of Penguin Random House.
Can I ask you a question about your bio that I'm fascinated by?
Of course.
Did you have your Harvard degree before or after you were a country music singer?
A little bit during. I played 75 shows my junior year and about 100 as a senior.
That is amazing. What were you studying at Harvard?
Folklore and mythology.
That is such a cool... Can I ask you about your life story? We have a couple more minutes, and I'm totally fascinated by your background because I feel like it's all intertwined.
Yeah, I'm glad you feel that way. I do, too. Some people are a little confused, but the through line for me is, you know, agrarian stories, basically, stories of the rural American West. I'm just totally fascinated by what people come up with out of this life experience of stewarding a natural resource and working directly with the land. And in one way or another, I've been fascinated with that my entire life.
That's awesome. And you have used your obvious intelligence and incredible storytelling ability to put together this book, Lentil Underground. Liz Carlisle, thank you so much for coming on Sharp and Hot.
Thanks, Chef Emily.
And I hope this is your last of the day, right? So you're done with the radio interviews?
Yes.
Okay.
I think lunch and then a nap.
Excellent. Have a wonderful afternoon.
You too.
Oh, man, you guys, that was awesome. The book is great. I have my copy, and as soon as I'm done with it, I am going to send it to one of you guys, lucky listeners out there who are using the Sharp and Hot hashtag on Instagram. I sent out a whole package, whole pile of packages to listeners who have posted pictures of your food photography, and you guys are so cute because you post pictures back, and I get to see your open up and, you know, my handwriting in your living room, which is awesome. It is also National Toast Day, which is not, you know, I don't usually go in for the made up holidays because I feel like they're annoying and there's too many of them. But I freaking love toast. And I woke up this morning, I was like, oh my God, it's Toast Day. So if you go on Instagram, you'll see that I took a video this morning in my classroom of myself making a piece of toast in the salamander. And I got some mileage out of an essay that I wrote in 2011 that was one of my truly life-changing moments that I'll share the story with you. I don't know how this landed in my inbox, but one day I got an email that said that the Symposium for Professional Food Writers was looking for, or was like, it was open season for scholarships. And I didn't know what that was, and I didn't know what I was applying for a scholarship for, but I don't know. It was $500 title, or 500 words rather, titled My Favorite Dish. And I was like, yeah, I'll apply for this. And I can't remember who sent it to me. I can't find the email itself. So I don't know if it was a friend or it just came like out of the ether. But I wrote this story about my favorite dish, which is toast. And in my planning process, I was like, people are going to write about per se or truffles or duck or some foie gras or something. And I was like, if I can make toast sexy, I might be able to pull this off. So I wrote the essay and I mailed it off and kind of either maniacally hit refresh on my inbox for a while and then probably forgot about it. And then one day I was riding the bus in Brooklyn, and I learned that I'd won. And so it meant that I got to go to this Symposium for Professional Food Writers, which I did not consider myself one of at the time. And it was like a little stressful because I was felt like I might be an imposter in this room of esteemed people that I was like super fan of. And I went, and it was one of the most life-changing experiences of my entire life. I have Don and Joan Fry to thank. They were the people who funded my scholarship that allowed me to go. And I had a moment with someone who's become a dear friend named Jess Thompson. I was standing in a group of people talking about food writing, of all things, and I was like, yeah, this essay that had this incredible impact on me. And I was like going on and on and on and on about how wonderful it was. And I wish I could write like that. And oh, I just loved it. And she looked at me and she said, I wrote that. And I was like, what? So I was literally in the right room. And when I got to meet Don and Joan, Don said to me that when they were reading the essays, he and his wife, and looking for who the person was to be the winner, that they wanted somebody who just needed a hand into that room. And that still makes me a little bit like teary-eyed to think about, because that humble meal of breakfast toast literally changed my life. So I will say that the Symposium for Professional Food Writers is going to be held this year in September. You can... I should also say it's going to be at the Culinary Vegetable Institute in Milan, Ohio, which is one of my very favorite places, with Farmer Lee Jones. And so you can just Google Symposium for Professional Food Writers if that's something that you would like to participate in. I am living proof that you can literally become the person that you want to be through something as simple as 500 words about your favorite meal. So that's that, my public service announcement about my my favorite dish. And Jack just came into the studio. And Jack, you were sick last week, and I know everyone is waiting to make sure that you're okay. Are you okay?
I'm okay, yes.
I saw your picture in Miami, and I was like, did you just pull a Rihanna? Because Rihanna said she was sick for the Grammys, but then she was out partying 2 days later.
I mean, I was sick. Come on, it was Tuesday. That picture was on Saturday. No, it was a stomach virus that apparently took over the entire school that my girlfriend Odetta works at. So some school spread virus.
Oh, man. Dirty little children.
It was awful, Emily.
And you're okay now?
I am.
Okay, good. And engineer Dave got to eat your empanada and your truffles because I brought you snacks to make sure you weren't hungry. Little did I know that was the least of your problems that day.
I took it right out of your mouth, Jake.
Are you guys fans of toast? Are you celebrating National Toast Day?
I will. Now that I know about it.
Yeah. How do you feel about the fake holidays?
I hate them.
Yeah, I hate them.
Yeah,
too.
I really hate them.
Is there ever one that like strikes you, though, where you're like, no. I hate them, but National DJ Day.
No, never.
Not even National DJ Day?
No. I like International Women's Day. That one was cool. I like Mother's Day, Father's Day. Those are cool. But, I mean.
And I say, as a parent.
Yeah, you do.
It's a lot of pressure.
Why?
Oh, it's a long... So for one thing, I love my kid. Like, you guys know that I adore my child. But I feel like it's a lot of pressure on him to be like, oh, and we're going to set aside this other day, and I'm going to make you stuff. I'm like, I would rather that he just felt, like, excited about his parents every day. I don't know. And then if your parent isn't someone that you are super tight with, I feel like you've got to... I will speak in the first person. I've got to avoid social media on a lot of that because I'm just like, it's not for me. So I am trying to approach Mother's Day from the place of being a mother who likes it. But I got to say, it's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, well.
I mean, I will say the first.
So is National Toast Day, Emily.
No, wait, man. National Toast Day could be every day. It's National Ice Cream Day. It's National Hot Fudge Day. It's National Whipped Cream Day. Can we just put them all in, like, let's just get one National Sunday?
Yeah, I like that idea.
All right. I'm glad to hear that you are feeling better. I am thrilled to have had my guest Liz Carlisle on. I am going to leave it there, everybody. Oh, one other thing. Thank you to you guys who went and reviewed the show on iTunes. I'm so touched. I got two new reviews this week, and they're really, really thoughtful and sweet. If you are listening and you haven't had a chance to go to iTunes, please do so. It makes our show run up the recommended charts, and it means that I get to see that you're out there listening, as does the emailing me your questions and at Sharp and Hot. At Chef Emily P on Twitter. Thank you to David for engineering the show. Thank you to Nice Peter for the theme song. And until next week, everybody, keep playing with fire and knives.
Sharp and hot with Chef Family. Sharp and hot with Chef Family.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money.
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos.
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.